If you haven't heard, Utah is growing, and growing fast.
Like, the population is expected to double by 2050 fast.
Whoa, really? So that means in less than 3 decades, Utah's going to be made up of a whole 6 million people?
Yep.
Nutty. What the heck does that mean for our politics? I'm Sage Miller.
And I'm Sean Higgins. This week on State Street, does a growing Utah mean it's destined to go blue or some shade of purple?
Voters we talk to certainly think so. And some Democratic Party insiders really hope so. They're hard at work to make that a reality.
Plus, it wouldn't be the first time a red state in the West flipped blue.
So what can Utah learn from the curious case of Colorado?
First, let's start with where Utah voters think our good old beehive state might be headed, politically speaking. I asked our voter panel earlier this fall what Utah might look like 10 or 15 years in the future.
I think it's purple.
Purple.
I suspect purple.
Purple. And I'm thrilled about that because I'm a centrist and I'm excited. I think that kind of meeting in the middle and pragmatism offers a lot of hope.
We're going to get all voices to the table. And when we do that, it's going to be messy. So it's going to be purple.
I hope it's red, but, you know, ballot initiatives come from out of Utah. And there's a lot of direct democracy that could change our situation.
The state's growing. People are coming in from out of state. But even if they weren't, a new generation of people, the young people you talk to, they tend to be more inclined to be away from both major parties. I think we're on the verge of a realignment or something different.
That was Bridgette Weir, Kimberly Wagner, Randy Miguel, and Nikki Brammer. This group spanned the political spectrum from liberal Democrat to conservative Republican.
And if my memory serves me correctly, Sean, aren't Utah Republicans a tad petrified that the state will follow in Colorado's blue footsteps?
For all you State Street superfans, you might remember Zach Wilson.
No, not the Denver Broncos quarterback.
Right. Utah politics Zach Wilson is a millennial who ran for Congress as a Republican in the 3rd District. We spoke with him in June, and here's what he had to say about where he sees the state going.
Yeah, you look at Colorado, which used to be a red state, and then as Denver grew, the state swung more purple and now more solidly blue. And so I look at that here in Utah, and a lot of the I see very similar demographic. Utah's solidly red state, but as Salt Lake grows, tech jobs grow, the outdoor kind of wonderland that we have here in state and more outdoorsy-minded people come here. I think we're 10 years from being in Colorado if we can't better message with young people.
Okay, fine. Even if there is some fear over it, fear doesn't always mean reality.
You're absolutely right. You and I cover elections for a living, but it doesn't take a crystal ball to say with almost complete certainty that Utah will not be turning blue in 2024. The math just doesn't work there. But things do change. The state certainly looks pretty different now than it did even 10 years ago. So what would it take for Dems to win in Utah?
And we're not talking about, like, flip the entire state, make it blue, California, here we come! We're talking about, like, when could the legislature be a little less supermajority-y?
Even that is tough in a state like Utah, for various reasons we won't dive totally into this episode.
But Sean, I spoke with a relatively new left-leaning political consulting firm that popped up in Utah 2 years ago. They're called Elevate Strategies, and they're all in on making Utah more competitive politically. Gabby Finlayson is a co-founder of Elevate. She's worked in politics her entire career and grew up in Utah County, so she's no stranger to the battle the firm is up against. She says she was working on some out-of-state campaigns in 2022 when she had an aha moment.
I mean, the reason I decided to move back was, you know, I was sitting in the Massachusetts State Senate and they were talking about, you know, whether Medicare for All or single payer would be better for the people of Massachusetts. And on the exact same day, the Utah legislature had passed the anti-trans sports bill. And it was such an interesting dichotomy in my mind, just thinking like there are so many people in Utah that don't agree with this. And we saw that online. You know, we eventually saw even the governor, you know, vetoing that bill. You know, Utahns aren't into this whole, you know, the very divisive, crude kind of politics that we've seen out of the Republican Party. And even the rumblings of having Evan McMullen run as an independent and kind of seeing how people were really interested in something that wasn't the Republican Party. You know, it was a wild moment to just think like, okay, like we can do this and we can actually make progress. I mean, we're the youngest state in the country. We're the fastest growing state in the country. We have a single media market, which means you can buy, you know, one TV ad and you get shown to, you know, everyone in the state, which is helpful for us in politics, right? Because it's a lot cheaper to actually run races. And at the same time, on the Democratic side, we didn't really see competitive elections because people with national experience, like myself and my business partners, weren't running real campaigns. You know, we famously always see some yard signs and signs on overpasses and billboards and hope and pray for the best.
So the million-dollar question, what is your strategy to get more Dem victories in Utah?
Yeah, that's a good question. it certainly is a long play, I will say. But, you know, one of the things that we're doing is, you know, early investment in candidates and doing real candidate recruitment and finding candidates that actually fit the district, not just, you know, who is willing to be like, quote unquote, as that's something called, you know, sacrificial lambs with their name on the ballot. But more broadly than that, you know, we've been doing a ton of candidate training. So we've trained over 60 candidates in the last 2 years, you know, teaching them early on, not just how to run a campaign, but how do you be a candidate in a real way? And how do you communicate, you know, not just what you want to do in office, but what are your values and why do you want to help the people that you're trying to represent?
Are there any test cases that made you feel like this was possible?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the most one-to-one example that we see is Colorado. You know, we can see that there are a big changes happening, that we are not only seeing, you know, a lot of growth in our state internally, but people moving here, similar to what happened in Colorado. We're seeing that people are open to doing something differently, which is exactly what happened in Colorado. Similar to what happened in Georgia, right? No one ever expected Georgia to elect two Democratic senators, but because of years of true on-the-ground organizing, they did see that happen. And it didn't just happen because demographics changed enough and, you know, the trend line one day just said, okay, now you're a blue state.
Yeah.
But it took a lot of years of work in order to make that happen. And, you know, we're really proud to be, you know, doing that work now in hopes that in a few cycles, we will see some big changes here in the state.
So how hard is it to actually recruit good Dems?
It's hard to recruit good people anywhere, right? I mean, we see this across the board and people don't love politicians, but we are super focused on down ballot races. So the state house and the state senate is kind of where we see the most progress to be made and the most opportunity. But it's really difficult to, you know, have good people who have real jobs and real lives look at the legislature and how contentious it is and what's going on and think like, oh, yeah, I'd love to be a part of that. That seems like a really great use of my time. When in reality, you know, we know that when we do have more Democrats and even more independents, people that just aren't part of that, you know, Republican monopoly, the more of them there are, the more responsive the Republican Party has to be and the more moderated they have to become.
What exactly are Dems in Utah doing wrong right now in the status quo?
You know, I'm not necessarily sure they're doing a lot wrong, but I think we could be doing a lot more right. And so one of the things that we're doing is, again, trying to professionalize campaign work. So not just, you know, saying like, well, we'll just go to parades and events and put up some yard signs, but being a lot more targeted and intentional about the way that we're talking to voters. And on top of that, the thing that I will preach about until the day I die is something that we call relational organizing, which is not just, you know, doing the door knocking and the cold phone calling to try and talk to voters, but really engaging with people to talk to their personal network. So saying, you know, if I call your best friend and tell them who they should vote for, that's not going to be anywhere near as effective as if you called your best friend and told them, hey, this is the person I'm supporting and here's why. And one of the things that we've been really excited about is that Utah, especially, you know, the LDS culture is perfectly set up for relational organizing. Uniquely here, people know their neighbors. They spend a ton of time with them. They see them every Sunday, right? And so trying to tap into that and do more of that one-to-one relationship building and using those relationships in order to have better conversations about our shared values is something that I would like to see us do a lot more of.
So how do you make inroads in purple and red districts to try and get Dems elected to the state legislature?
Especially folks that have their entire life voted for Republicans. That's what their parents did, what their grandparents did. A lot of it is based on tradition and habit and less on, you know, critical kind of evaluation of which candidate maybe aligns best with their values. And I think one of the other things that we're seeing really interestingly right now is, again, these running of independent and third party candidates in order for people to think about, like, okay, maybe I'm not ready to make the leap to say, like, I voted Republican my whole life, but now I'm going to vote for a Democrat. But what if we just think about, you know, Republican or not Republican? Can we get them to vote for an unaffiliated candidate or a third party candidate? And we've seen that is a lot easier of a first kind of like baby step for people to feel okay about that. And I think the other big thing is trying to run candidates statewide that are a different kind of Democrat. You know, Utah Democrats are very different than, you know, New York or California Democrats. We just are. Also, I think because of who Utahns are, it just doesn't hit quite the same way, right? We are still very, you know, libertarian, freedom-centric.
What state legislature seats and what counties are you prioritizing?
Salt Lake County is obviously a place where we know we can make progress. There are 6 seats in Salt Lake County that are state legislative seats that were won by Democrats in 2022 and in 2020 that are currently held by Republicans. Those 6 seats are a top priority for us. We're also looking at Weber County. We know that we can make progress there. It is a historically blue place that has kind of flipped back red, and we're making a lot of progress there. Davis County, of course, is always a very interesting conversation for us. And then, you know, my dark horse being from Utah County, I really think we can make a lot more progress in Utah County.
What is your end goal? Flip Utah blue, have it be purple, make it more competitive? Like, what is it? What's the goal?
Yeah, I think, you know, the end goal for our company is to break the supermajority in both the House and the Senate. Breaking up that political monopoly is going to be better for people. We often, you know, joke that we're building a coalition of the willing to, you know, create a moderate governing majority, because that's what the people of the state of Utah deserve. They don't want the government constantly overstepping and having to sit in every legislative session thinking, what is the legislature going to do to me next? We should get to a place where we have moderate Republicans, independents, third party candidates if needed, and Democrats that are doing the work to actually make people's lives better, instead of having to rely on the supermajority to maybe hopefully do the right thing this time.
And how long do you think it's going to take?
We hope about 8 years. Yeah, before the next redistricting cycle is kind of our end goal here.
That was Gabby Finlayson, co-founder of Elevate Strategies, a left-leaning political consulting firm in Utah.
We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, what happened in Colorado? And could something similar be in store for Utah?
Hey, I'm David Childs, a producer of State Street. We know there's a lot at stake this election year, and we're here to break it down for you every step of the way. So I want to take a minute to ask for your support. The only way that we at KUER are able to produce projects like State Street is with donations from the local community. People like you who value the content we provide for Utahns across the state. If you can, take a minute and donate to support projects like State Street. Go to KUER.org/support and help us continue bringing you the latest in Utah politics. And thanks.
Support for State Street comes from the Hinckley Report on PBS Utah. I'm Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. The Hinckley Report is Utah's weekly political roundup, bringing together Utah's top journalists, political thinkers, and lawmakers to help you understand how politics impacts your life. Listen to the Hinckley Report wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to State Street. I'm Sean Higgins.
And I'm Sage Miller. We just heard from Gabby Finlayson. Her political consulting firm has an ambitious 8-year plan to make Utah more politically competitive.
And their strategy, as they see it, candidate quality, recruitment, and investment into those races to change the political tides.
Sean, did you catch the state they were looking at as an example of what to do to move the needle?
Sure did. They are quite literally taking a page out of Colorado's book.
Exactly. Colorado was primarily Republican for decades. That was until 2004, when the state saw a huge shift to the left. Democrats won up and down the ballot that year, and people were like, WTF is happening in Colorado?
Well, to learn a little more about just what went down in the Centennial State 20 years ago, I turned to Rob Whitwer. He served as a Republican in the Colorado legislature from 2005 to 2009. In 2010, he wrote a book called The Blueprint: How the Democrats Won Colorado and Why Republicans Everywhere Should Care. He told me what it was like serving during this huge shift in Colorado politics.
Well, there's no question there's been a major demographic shift in Colorado in the last 20 years. However, this was on the very front end of that. So demographics alone don't explain the change in 2004. I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that if 2004 hadn't have changed the way it did, that that change would have happened eventually just by virtue of the in-migration of new people into Colorado who were very, very heavily on the blue team. But at the time, in 2004, the real forcing mechanism for this change was campaign finance reform. Both at the federal level and critically here at the state level, campaign finance reform was passed by the voters of Colorado. And what it did was kill political parties. Historically, political parties had been the mechanism of campaign infrastructure, the blocking and tackling, spending money, running television advertisements, supporting targeted candidates, canvassing, polling, issue generation, issue promotion, all of that kind of thing. After campaign finance reform, political parties couldn't do any of that. And so very quickly, Democrats recognized the vacuum that was created by campaign finance reform. And that vacuum was filled by a collection of nonprofit organizations. That became the campaign infrastructure for Democrats in 2004.
Talk a little bit about the GOP in Colorado. What was it like when they were controlling all the levers of power? What did Republicans in Colorado care about? What were their central issues?
Historically, Colorado has been a libertarian-leaning purple state. You know, in the era that I grew up in the 70s through the 2000s, Colorado elected Republicans and Democrats at the state level and at the local level tended more overwhelmingly to be Republicans. So the state legislature was strongly Republican. And so it was a balanced state. But I would say more than anything, there was a libertarian lean both to the Democrats and the Republicans, very much a live and let live mentality. Starting in the mid-90s, the Republican Party became much more focused on social issues. And that, I think, led to a backlash at the polls to some degrees. I get a lot of feedback on the book that, well, the story of the blueprint is the story of a group of Democratic donors buying the state of Colorado. And, you know, that's not the takeaway that I have. The takeaway that I have is that it was a combination of factors. One of those factors was the fact that the Republican Party grew progressively out of step with the voters of Colorado. And at the same time, you had a structural change, which was campaign finance reform. And Democrats recognized that and were able to replace and replicate the political infrastructure that parties used to serve. And the rightward drift of the Republican Party created a messaging opportunity for those new entities to capitalize on.
Republicans have such a firm grip on politics here in Utah. You really hear from political insiders that in the Utah GOP, there's really three parties. There's kind of the MAGA crowd, there's the more traditional, loyal Republican voter, and then there's this third bucket of people who are kind of persuadable by maybe an independent candidate or an unaffiliated candidate. Do you think that particular makeup of having these three strains of a dominant party, does that make it easier or harder for big political changes to happen?
The blueprint story is about what happened in the early 2000s in Colorado, but I think there's a strong case to be made that there were some preconditions that happened in the 1990s that really accelerated the change. And one of those preconditions was a fracturing of the Republican Party along, on the one hand, social conservative lines, and on the other, your more traditional Republicans. I remember a time back in the 1980s when the Republican Party was dominant in the state legislature in Colorado, and there was not just one, but a handful of pro-choice Republican legislators in the Colorado House of Representatives and in the Colorado Senate. That in the 1990s, it no longer became possible for a Republican to hold certain views and make it through a primary. So the party really narrowed its set of issues that were that one could hold and still make it through a primary and find themselves on a general election ballot. So to the extent that there is in Utah a fragmented Republican Party, that creates an opening for the kinds of divisions that you we saw in Colorado in the 90s and early 2000s, which were contested primaries between pretty firmly divergent ideological groupings. And then what would happen is, regardless of who the winner was, in some case it was the social conservatives, in other cases it was your more kind of traditional Republicans, the losing side would not support the winning side. And that took a historically safe Republican seat, let's say, for example, a state House seat or state Senate seat, and put it into play. And if the Democrats could come to that race with a good candidate, if they selected a good candidate who was talking about issues that were resonant with the voters, and at the same time, they brought to the table stronger infrastructure, better blocking and tackling on the campaign side, that seat would flip. And we saw that story replicate itself over and over and over again, especially in the early 2000s.
Do you see similarities between Utah and Colorado, or are Utah and Colorado different states? Because I think when we think of an outsider looking at the Mountain West, they see a state with a very outdoorsy population who's growing really fast. They're the same, right?
I understand Colorado, but I wouldn't pretend to understand Utah. That said, I do know there's a lot of in-migration patterns from the coasts, and that tends to change over time, the demographics of the state. It's interesting, you do see some states like Idaho and Montana that are moving somewhat rightward, just based on the party registration and results of elections. Obviously, Colorado's moved leftward. And so I think that it's when you have that volatile of population changes and you're adding millions of people over the course of multiple decades, anything's possible.
If you were writing your book in 2024, how would it change?
Yeah, the technology changes. Now it's just unthinkable that you wouldn't have a website, a social media presence, a digital campaign of some kind, especially in a targeted race. So those things have changed. But the universal things that will never change are, it's important to have money. Money is the lifeblood of political campaigns. Back in those days, money was spent through political parties. Now it's spent through independent organizations that are unaccountable to the candidates and the parties. That's just a fact. But the underlying truth that you need money to fund these types of campaigns, that's still there. Another underlying truth is candidate quality. You have to have good candidates. The candidates have to be representative of the district they're running to serve. They need to be in touch generally with the voters that they want to represent. And they need to be able to communicate that in a way that's not off-putting to voters. And then finally, organization and coordination. What really stood out to me was the coordination of the donors and the groups that were running the campaign infrastructure in Colorado. They did an excellent job of focusing their resources on races that could be won. They weren't spending money on vanity projects or races that were long shots. It was a very businesslike and analytical approach to how we spend money, how we coordinate our efforts, avoiding redundancy. That's another truth that will never change, no matter how the technology changes.
Well, Rob Whitwer, thank you so much for joining State Street. We appreciate your insight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was former Colorado State Representative and author Rob Whitwer.
All right. Reality check time, Sean. Utah isn't going to flip blue anytime soon.
It's a marathon for these folks, not a sprint. Former Congressman Ben McAdams, who you might remember from last week's episode, was the last Utah Democrat to serve in a federal seat. He represented the 4th District from 2019 to 2021. He told us he's a little more skeptical of Utah becoming purple.
I'd love to see that. I think Utah, we see that younger Utahns tend to be more politically independent, not as Republican as older Utahns. And then you see some of the growth in migration from other states that seems to be, they're probably largely Republicans who are moving here, but find that they are not Utah Republicans. And so they are also more independent minded. I don't see purple could be the direction we're heading. I would call it probably a reddish purple. That's going to take some time. I think it also is going to take honing our message. We're not going to win on a national message. We've got to show that Utah Democrats are different than the national Democrats, and people have to understand intuitively what that means. It's not going to happen just accidentally, or it's not just going to happen organically. It's got to be, I think, strategic.
For Elevate Strategies, they're aware of the uphill battle, but they're looking to flip seats in districts that are already competitive or have the ability to become competitive, which are in the most populated areas in Utah.
Yeah, like Salt Lake, Weber, Davis, and Utah counties. So the Wasatch Front.
And there are competitive races in Salt Lake County this cycle. There's a chance some seats held by Republicans in the legislature could flip. That would chip away at the supermajority, but it wouldn't change the entire game.
Help me put that into perspective.
For sure. So if there were even just a few more Democrats or independents in the Utah House, for example, it would make it harder to pass constitutional amendments. You need two-thirds of the voting body to approve a constitutional amendment. Amendment D, which we talked all about earlier this season, eked through with only 5 votes to spare in the House and 2 in the Senate. In other words, if just a few more people voted against it, it wouldn't have even made it onto the ballot. P.S. Another reminder, no votes will count on Amendment D.
But even with the Colorado test case, Utah just isn't Colorado, period. Sure, it may look similar at first glance, but our culture and our politics are different. We dedicated a whole episode to how Latter-day Saints approach politics last year. While they aren't a monolith, most are loyal Republican voters.
Plus, as our Colorado friend put it, money is your best friend. And Democrats and independents are going to need a lot more dough to rise.
Sage is on her personal bread-making journey.
I am! And like the Democrats, it's a work in progress. So bread tips are appreciated.
Also, politics is pretty weird. Crazy things happen all the time. People have been saying Texas is going blue for years, and guess what? Still pretty red.
Right. And all those people who said Florida would always be a swing state, I wonder how they feel now that it's bright red.
All this to say, we're not sure how this will shake out over the next decade, but we will hopefully get a glimpse into the future next week.
That's right. We'll be back for a post-election wrap-up. You can bet we'll be looking at whether the Dems' focus on down-ballot races paid off.
That does it for this episode of State Street. I'm Sean Higgins.
And I'm Sage Miller.
Election day is less than 1 week away, people.
Planning an election night watch party? Check out some of our tips for a successful evening in our State Street newsletter. You can sign up at our website.
And if you've got feelings on election night, call us and leave us a voicemail at 801-581-5015.
Which spells absolutely nothing. Fun fact, there are no letters on the 0 or the 1 buttons on your phone. So I'll say the number again slowly. 801-581-5015.
State Street is not possible without a whole lot of people. Our digital team is Jim Hill, Raquel Davis, and Eleanor Gomberg.
David Childs and KUER News Director Elaine Clark are responsible for editing and audio production here at State Street.
And Caroline Ballard is our executive producer.
See you next week. Democrats won up and down the ballot that year, and people were like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You almost said it.
I did. That's, stop myself.
From KUER.